you're actually facing, and you use that for your spiritual practice. How do we do that? By stopping. You pause when you feel the fear, instead of just jumping to your automatic reaction, which is to run away or cling. And I admit that I am coming from a fear place, and I allow myself to feel the fear here and now. And I don't have to be forced to act on the fear, even though I have it. So this is, in a sense, acting with your feeling, with the feeling, instead of waiting for the feeling to go before you can act. First, I have to get rid of the fear. Then I can be more intimate. No. This is a different approach. I need to act with the fear, take the fear with me, rather than wait till it goes away. Because it isn't going to go away. It's a part of the human psyche to feel all these feelings. You'll feel it every day in one way or another. But you no longer have to be stopped by it. And you no longer have to be driven by it. This is the redemptive news, that the fear no longer has to stop me. It's no longer a compulsion, because that's what these are. These are compulsive fears. They compel you to contract your heart, to cover it, protect it, rather than open it in the more vulnerable way. Many religious images show the God with the heart on the outside. It's a way of saying, oh, that heart just needs to be presented and given, not held in and protected. In fact, in the Hindu tradition, Hanuman looks into his own heart and sees Krishna and Radha there loving each other. So, you know, you could see the possibility of relationship when you're able to open that heart and look in. This is how it opens. So applying this to the fear of engulfment would simply mean, as a start, I admit that I feel crowded. I allow myself to feel it. And while feeling it, I let you hug me one more minute than I can stand. And the next time I'll add another minute. That's about all I can offer. That's a lot, because that minute is exponential. It's like the little two above a number. That's not a two. That multiplies the whole thing by itself. So you get a lot of credit. On this side, on the abandonment side, I admit that I'm caught in this fear, compulsively caught in this fear of being abandoned. Even though my mind says I'll survive without you, the cells of my body don't believe it. And I allow myself to feel that fear rather than avoiding or denying it. And I let you be distant for one more minute than I can stand before I start the clinging. So that's what I'm offering. I'm offering one more minute of safety before I grab. This is how you would work things out in a relationship. Okay, I'll go with it. Can you make it like an extra half hour instead of a minute? You know, you can kind of dicker with the numbers, but what you're basically trying to do here is you're trying to get over something that went in at a time when you had no control over it, that is in childhood, and went in over and over and over again, 1,000 times. So it's going to take 1,000 times before it finally releases its grip. What is causing it to grip us? The fear itself. Remember, there's nothing to fear but fear itself. It's the fear itself that seems to have a little life of its own and wants to survive. And there's something in us that, you know, keeps going back to the fear place. I'm going to let that be okay. I'm going to say, oh, okay, go back to the fear place, but when you get there, I'm going to pull out my 3 A's, and I'm going to do this over and over and over, and I'm going to trust that at some point it's going to make a difference. So that's our technique for working with these fears. And of course, it's an invitation once you understand these fears to be enormously compassionate towards your partner who feels as he or she does. Because of course, this side, fear of closeness, will read out on the screen as coldness. And this one, fear of abandonment, will read out on the screen as neediness. So of course, they don't look too good. And you have to have enough compassion to be able to see something else going on. What else is going on? A terror. T-E-R-R-O-R. It's a terrifying possibility that you might be held, and when you're held, you're not in control. The terrifying possibility that somebody might go, and when he goes, you're not in control. That's what it ultimately comes down to. These are fears of not being in control over the givens of ourselves and others. Okay, questions on this before we go on? Yes. Okay, I'll paraphrase. She's asking about what happens in a relationship when both of us feel the both fears, but one predominates with one fear and the other with another. Do I have that right? And it's often the man on this side with the engulfment and the woman on this side with the abandonment. Although I've also seen it the other way. You would have to notice, first of all, and be able to say the emperor has no clothes. You'd have to be able to say, look at what we're doing. I'm trying to hold on while you're trying to get away. And you're trying to get distance from a person for whom distance is the most terrifying of all options. And I'm trying to hold on to you for whom being held is the worst possibility of all. So we need to place this between us as an issue that we have to look at together so that we can work something out. And of course, one way to do that is with this as your project. We're going to admit when we have this fear, we're going to allow it, and then we're going to act in such a way that it no longer stops or drives us. You really can talk like this. You can really make it this matter of fact. See, the problem is that it all gets so caught up in blaming. Blaming is one of the trickster's methods to distract us from wholeness, to make sure we don't get to the place of wholeness. And this trickster I'm referring to is not the archetype. It's the shadow of ego. It's the dark side of the ego that wants to protect its important place in the world, wants to make sure that it gets its way. And that will always have something to do with controlling. There was another question. Yes. Mm-hmm. Thank you. She's bringing up a good point. Often, the one who has the fear of engulfment, as soon as the other person starts feathering her nest, make sure I got somebody to go to because it might not happen here, suddenly this flips and becomes the fear of abandonment. So the one who fears engulfment switches, becomes the one who fears abandonment as soon as you start to pull something away. Because remember, you're fearing the closeness, but you desperately need the connection. That's the problem. The way to see this is that if you just feared the closeness, you wouldn't even go into a relationship. But the fact that you went into a relationship means you want connection, but you want it on your terms. You want to be in control of how it is doled out. So the fear of engulfment happens in the context of carefully tending the connection to make sure that it goes on. So this guy will do all the nice things occasionally to keep you there. He knows how to do that because he wants to maintain that connection. See, it's a little different from on this side. On the other side with the abandonment, it's the pure fear of abandonment. But here there's another little wrinkle. I fear engulfment from too much closeness, but I want connection anyway. So as soon as the connection is jeopardized, so by the other, then I will suddenly fear that I'm being abandoned and will lose my connection. Everybody see how it works? Yes. She's saying sometimes in a relationship, you're called on the carpet by your partner because, well, you should have more of your own self-confidence. You shouldn't be so dependent upon me. And, of course, the answer to that may not be a welcome one, but you would have to get it that self-confidence, this part, the FID part, means trust. So it's that you trust yourself. That's self-confidence. But it doesn't mean that you're a solo operator. It's not a rugged individualism. You bring the self-confidence into the holding environment of the relationship. So it's not a sign that you're not self-confident because you're trying to get some needs met from the other. This is the context in which that's supposed to happen. Everybody follow? This would be like going into the bank and to make a withdrawal from your account and the person saying, you're supposed to have your own money. You're not supposed to be. No, the purpose of our contract is I can come here and get money as long as it's in there. Yeah.
I'm just wondering if it's ever the case that one person can have a holding environment by themselves or feel it from something external other than a person.
Absolutely. You can achieve a holding healing environment within yourself. That's what happens on a retreat, for instance. And it also happens within a sangha, you know, when you have a group of people that practice together. It happens in family, happens in friendship. It doesn't have to be just an intimate relationship.
But what about like someone like Thoreau? His holding environment was nature.
Yes, nature would be an example of a holding environment that helps us with our fear. Very good example. I do want to go on to our other topic because we don't have a lot of time left. And that is, of course, how to continue doing the work besides what we just said. What are some ways to work things out? And I'd like to begin with first that word stay again. The first way you work things out is to stay long enough to work them out. And, of course, our practice of mindfulness when we're sitting on the pillow and we're staying, basically trying to remain aware of how our mind juggles us and we are not attaching ourselves to the thoughts as they come through, nor are we attempting to banish them. We are simply noticing them and letting them pass through. That's how the practice helps us stay. So now apply that to relationship. I am not banishing you, and I am not clinging to you. I'm simply letting you be here as you are. And when I do that, that's the equivalent of staying, and it's the first step in working things out. And this working things out takes the following forms. It's a three-step process. First, you have to look at the situation that you're in. So you have to address. So the first step is addressing the issue. I have a problem with your being online for so many hours. And I looked at the history trail. I know what's going on there. And let's put our cards on the table. Instead of, oh, I better not say anything, I'll just tell my friend. But, you put it out there. So this will be a hard one because we were taught that was rude to do. But in a relationship, it's no holds barred. So you got to bring things up if you want to get them looked at and worked on. Otherwise, it'd be like going to the doctor and say, oh, I just got a terrible cut and I think I need stitches. Well, let's see it. No, I can't. Okay, so the second is processing. This is a big one. Here you may need help. That's obviously where therapy comes in. I'll explain what I mean by processing. But when you address and process together, they add up to step three, which is resolving. So it's 1, 2 equals 3. And resolving happens when you step out of the wheel of the samsara, caught in fear and desire, and instead you stop the cycle of pain, stop repeating what you were doing, and agree to a new paradigm, to a new way of being together, which will, of course, be shown in practical ways. But now let me go back to the processing. So everybody follows how it works. You bring the issue out to address it. You process it together. And then you come up with some way of resolving. This will happen automatically from the addressing and processing. And I will give an example. But first, regarding the processing. You have to basically see into the issue. And the way to the issue is look for the shadow side of it. What is the hidden, dark, or even possibly malicious, or even ignorant feature of this issue from my point of view? You can't tell the other person his shadow. You have to let him come up with that on his own. But if you're really willing to work together, you would have to admit that there's some shadow dimension to this I need to look at. Shadow. Hidden with possibly a less than ideal motive. Secondly, you have the ego. And this would be a whole separate workshop because this is a big one. That's simply the Latin word for I. But the neurotic ego, which is the one we're letting go of in our practice, not the healthy ego. Healthy ego is the part that observes reality, acts in accord with it, sets goals to achieve something, does what it takes to accomplish. That's healthy ego. Stop at the light when you're supposed to. Healthy ego. Neurotic ego, that's described very simply. It's the part that has to be in control of how it's all going to go, and feels that it's entitled to be on top, to get special privileges, to get exemptions from what everybody else has to go through, etc. So you have to admit that there's something of that in what you're doing. You see, in some situations, the ego simply wants to assert itself and come out on top in a competitive way. But in a healthy relationship, it's not a matter of two competing egos brushing up against each other's entitlements. It's two egos that give themselves up for the success of the bond. See, we hadn't thought of it that way. That the two egos bow to each other, and from that bowed position comes the bond, rather than that the two egos asserted themselves. So I can either establish my ego by taking a position in the relationship that shows that I'm right. That's establishing your ego. Or I can have a different motive. Instead of establishing my ego for my own rightness, I dispossess myself of ego for the health of the relationship. It's a whole different way of operating. How do you process? That's how. You have to dispossess yourself of ego for the good of the relationship. You'd have to see where you're competing, see where you're controlling, see where you're entitled, believe yourself entitled, see where you're holding on to a position, See where you're compulsively having to be right. That's part of the processing. And the final part is, how does what happens in your early life take effect right this minute? Your mother did this to you, and now you see me as doing it to you, and I'm not really doing it. Or your mother did this to you, and I am doing it, and we need to work on that. So it helps to remember in this simple word, see, I'm trying to see. And I've been using this also whenever I'm upset by something. I say, okay, how is this about my own shadow projections? How is this about establishing my own ego authority? How is this related to my early life? Just doing those three, you get enormous information about what's going on. And remember, most of us don't want this kind of information. We don't want to know this. We don't want to know that we're controlling, entitled, competing, positioning. No, I'm not like that. That's other people like that. Well, most people don't want to know they have a hidden side with some darker motives. Or even that there's anything about the early life that affects the present life. Oh, that's just like psychological BS. That's not real. So that's what it takes to process. So how do you work through things? First, you're willing to look at what is happening. Second, you're processing what happens by looking at shadow side, ego side, early life side. And as a result, you're resolving, which means you're stopping the usual cycle and you're agreeing to a new way of doing things. Example. Relationship in which the man is not very attentive to the wife, but the wife has noticed that he now has a female friend at work. And they spend long hours talking about themselves to each other in what seems like a very intimate friendship. And he has acknowledged and stated that there's no sex involved. But the wife is still jealous because it seems like she is getting something that she, the friend, is getting something that she, the wife, is not getting. Everybody follow? Okay, good. So it sounds familiar to some. You've got some nerve spending so much time with her. That's not going to work. I see you spending time with her. I'm glad you found somebody to share with. And I want you to know its impact on me. So declaring the impact without blame. Of course, the retaliation would be if you try to find a friend that you could do that with. Then. So you want to declare the impact and have it be heard. If it's not heard, don't go on. You've got to stay right there until it's heard. Well, it's obvious that two adults, we can't seem to hear each other. We need to work on this in some other way. Talk to other couples, go to therapy, however you want to do it. But somehow you have to get it that this has an impact on me. And it's not just coming out of nowhere. And it's not just my imagination. This is real. And it really bothers me. So then you, if this is acceptable together, then you go on to the second part, which is to process it. So let me first admit that some of this is a projection because I've been hoping to have a friend like that. And I've even been making some, you might get in trouble if you said this one. I've been trying to meet men who could be friendly online. But somehow related to, you know, what's in you. And my ego is wounded because I thought I was the only one. I thought it was the centerpiece of your life. Now I see I'm not. And this reminds me of when my brother was born, and the rest of us seven girls felt like we no longer mattered. And it's that feeling. How do we resolve it? We all become friends together, or you spend equal time with me as you do with her, talking about the same things, or you somehow demote the friendship so that it doesn't have all that in it, you know, whatever agreement you want to make, and we're going to a new way of being together that will be more trustworthy and have more closeness. So that would be like a quick overall sketch of how this works. Obviously, it takes a lot. But somewhere in the addressing is where most of us will be stuck. First of all, we won't even address it. We'll just go straight into the blaming. If you saw that movie, Moonstruck, the scene at the table, and being Italian, I recognize that scene, having been in it many times. Where it doesn't even matter if there's a guest there for dinner, they bring up these very personal things. Anyway, the husband's having an affair, and the wife knows about it, and they haven't discussed it, and they're all at dinner with Cher and their boyfriend. And all of a sudden, the wife says, "You're going to have to stop seeing that woman." And, you know, she brought it up. So, I mean, you want to bring it up at the right time and place, but that'll be very much a cultural decision. But somehow you bring it up and, you know, I know about what's going on. Let's put our cards on the table. You can play close to the vest, but at some point you're going to have to show your hand. And that's the nature of relationship. You have to say things like this. Don't feel like you're being rude, because you're not. You know, you're, shall we say, protecting your own life and intimacy in this. So you want to declare what it feels like. In the book, I even suggest that if your partner is having an affair, you should send a letter to the new boyfriend, girlfriend, telling the impact. I want you to know how I feel about your relationship with my husband. Haven't been sleeping, haven't been eating, been very angry. Put it out there. Declare the impact. That's a way of doing the addressing. Just say how it feels to you without putting blame on the other. But, you know, this is what it feels like at this end. Put it that way. Questions about this part of the process of how you work things out? Yeah, good point. She's bringing up the example of how in our childhood we could have been in households where things weren't brought up. And so you never had models for how to bring things up. And I mean, you can learn it here, or you can learn it from the self-help movement, or you can even learn it from movies where they do bring things up. I finally figured out why they bring things up. I thought to myself, these people act in a much healthier way than the normal population. Why? Why do they bring things up? And I said, David, they bring things up because they only have 2 hours on the screen. So they've got to bring things up. But those people, those same actors living out in their own life, might not do it that way, if you see what I mean. So if you come from a background where you didn't see this, and I didn't even see processing or resolving. Everything was just always kind of up in the air, not quite finished. I never heard the word relationship until sophomore in high school, when the algebra teacher said, "What is the relationship between X and Y?" That's the first time I heard that word. So, I mean, you know, that's what we come from, usually. Yes?
Could you give a few more examples of the shadow, the motives? Just, I'm a little unclear on that.
Okay. Shadow simply refers to how we have certain And this would be the negative shadow. Because there's also a positive shadow, which has your untapped potential. The negative shadow contains, unconsciously, the traits that are unacceptable to you or to the rest of society. And even though you have these traits, you don't want to admit that you have them. So you do two things. And we all do this. You repress them, that is, make them unconscious, and you also project them, that is, see these traits, hate in others what you hide in yourself. Everybody follow? So that's what's meant by shadow. There's another entire other subject. Okay, any other questions?
Kind of a general question about the initial idea of the five A's.
Mm-hmm.
25%, or the other one only use like 15%.
Yeah.
Cause problems, or is that just kind of find its balance, or?
Should work itself out. Yeah. It'll only be a problem if one needs 100%. Right. Healthy people don't want a relationship with somebody who's looking for 100%. Because then you haven't really got a grown-up.
So when I read in a book about relationships, when an adult has a disability or a difficulty, let's say one that they talk about was ADHD, then different ones could be mental illness or different things. So what can you say about that and the work you're doing?
You mean if one of the partners has a mental illness?
Or maybe it's not as strong as the mental illness, but maybe it's a strong ADHD, so they cannot pay attention,
mm-hmm.
forget to keep their agreements, or...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a very good point. A person may not be keeping agreements because he doesn't even remember. So you'd have to show good faith by how you went to the person who could help you with your ADD or ADHD or mental illness, and I'm working on this because I want the relationship to work better, and it can't work as well if one of us has this untreated. So I show my interest in the relationship when I want to take care of this. And when I don't do anything about it and just let it be there, then it doesn't work as well. Yes. What's meant by buttons are pushed? Okay. So this is an example. This is where you can use your C approach, S-E-E. Buttons pushed, now we understand, really means this has touched something in my own shadow, a dark side of me that I don't want to look at. Dark just means unconscious. Or this is ruffling my ego, which gets easily ruffled. Or this is something from way back that I still haven't dealt with. That's what's meant by buttons are pushed. When you go here with buttons are pushed, you drop the blame of the one who pushed the button. Thank you, because you let me look at myself more deeply. Oh, yes. Thank you. See, if you really want to work on yourself, you appreciate every possible way in which the work is pointed out. It would take a lot of humility, which is the virtue of accepting the truth about oneself. I accept myself in all my lowliness, and I accept my greatness too. Thank you all.
We hope you have enjoyed this production of Making Love Last, How to Sustain Intimacy and Nurture Genuine Connection by David Rico. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.